See my spirit on the wind, across the lands beyond the hill. Friend and foe will meet again, those who died at Passchendaele.
Ah, that song rips. It just keeps building and expanding and getting better as it goes. The first verse kicks in and I thought, this sounds like what I always wanted from Iron Maiden. They've always created great driving rhythms that have a galloping feel to them, like on Run to the Hills. But then that chorus starts in such a subtle and unexpected way and builds with Dickinson's double track vocals, and before you can catch your breath, they are absolutely soaring. And I am soaring with them. I feel like I found the song that makes me feel the way true Iron Maiden fans feel when they listen to the band. I've always wanted to get it, and now I totally do. And it only took me 44 years. Even the solos are great. And I rarely even notice guitar solos. I think it's Adrian Smith, that just crushes that solo into that gorgeous bridge when Dickinson is wailing, "Blood is falling like the rain, its crimson cloak unveils again. The sound of guns can't hide their shame, and so we die in Passchendaele." It's just masterful. Lyrically, Dickinson always feels a little "just the facts, ma'am" to me. And he does that on this song as well, with "as we charge the enemy lines, a burst of fire and we go down." Thank you, just describe it all for me. But he does lift off into a really affecting poetry throughout, with lines like "cruelty has a human heart" and "terror of the men we kill, the human heart is hungry still." That's just great stuff, and I am so glad that I decided to do a series on World War I and force myself to play Iron Maiden again, or I would have never heard this incredible song. It's a fucking triumph. And now back to tragedy. And what better place to find the truly saddest shit in the panoply of human experiences than the Empire of Russia? As I alluded to on the A side, in 1917, Russian society was coming apart at the seams. And the story I'm going to tell you now is the fastest version of the disintegration of Tsarist Russia in the entire canon of heavy metal comedy podcasting. Trust me, I listened to all the others. This is the shortest one, because apropos of our topic, I too am Russian. Russian. You know what? That took me all night, and I'm a little tired, so I could really use your support here. Oh, and minor gold star warning in T-minus 3 pages on this one, FYI. Okay, so no more Stalin. And, ooh, happy accident there. We begin on March 1st, 1887. Wait, no, I'm sorry. If we're going to do czars, let's do czars right. Yeah, that's it. We begin on March 1st, 1887, the 6th anniversary of the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. We'll call him Alex II, grandfather to Tsar Nicholas II, the Russian Empire's final monarch. On that day, Alexander III, Alex III, was to visit a church where his father, the previous Tsar, Alex II, had been buried, when three members of what was called the People's Will Party were arrested carrying homemade dynamite filled with lead pellets and poisoned with strychnine, just for good measure. They were planning to assassinate Alex III on the anniversary of the day Alex II was assassinated, but instead they were rounded up by police and hanged 2 months later. One of the would-be assassins was a 21-year-old university student named Alexander Ilyich Ulanov. Now hang on to that name for a minute. Alexander Ilyich Ulanov. Alexander Ilyich Ulanov. Alexander Ilyich. Despite what Def Leppard will tell you, sometimes it is better to fade away than burn out. We now jump forward in time to 1904, when Tsar Nicholas II's wife, Alexandra, had given birth to their fifth child, and in answer to their deeply devout prayers, a son named Alexei. But because God is a cruel dick with a terrible sense of humor, the future heir to the Russian throne was born a hemophiliac, which awoke a terrible neurosis in his mother, the Tsarina Alexandra, who sought answers in the form of mysticism. She first turned to a well-known miracle worker and healer named Dr. Felipe, who died suddenly in 1905 because the only person he couldn't work healing miracles on was apparently himself. Look, I don't make the rules. That's just how fake magic works. It's at that time that a Russian peasant from Siberia named Grigory Rasputin is introduced to the royal couple and quickly becomes their closest and most trusted advisor. as he seems to be the only person capable of quelling Alexei's hemophiliac episodes. Rasputin becomes both incredibly powerful and a deeply divisive figure of the Russian court, who fucks his way through the royal palaces in a deeply drunken stupor, as would be expected of any holy man. The people love him because he's one of their own, and they suspect that he's pulling the strings behind the throne, and the Russian royals hate him for the very same reason. We jump forward again 10 years to August 1915, when Rasputin advises Nicholas II to take control of the Russian army himself. Every other advisor to Nicholas warns him that it would be a disaster to do so, because then the Tsar would be blamed for any military failure that happens during his watch. So Nicholas, demonstrating his unique talents as a monarch, decides he's already ruined a country, so it probably wouldn't be that hard to ruin an army as well. And he was right. He appoints himself the supreme commander of the Russian army.
All this is so unexpected. I want to thank Academy. These things are heavy. Thanks to my agent, Ari. No, don't boo. No, he's one of the good ones. And finally to all the little people. Peter Dinklage, that kid from Webster, and Gary Coleman. Rest in power, brother.
So Nicholas then has to leave St. Petersburg in the deeply incapable hands of his wife Alexandra and her stinky magical sidekick Rasputin. Well, it turns out that Nicholas II was terrible at two of the most important jobs in the world, and by 1917, food shortages were causing massive riots back in the capital. Meanwhile, Germany sees that Russia is collapsing from the inside, and so they send a sealed train from Zurich directly into the heart of St. Petersburg, carrying a deadly weapon that they hoped would accelerate the chaos within Russia. That weapon was a man named Vladimir Lenin, the socialist leader of a small but radical political party known as the Bolsheviks, who had been exiled from Russia after a failed attempt at revolution in 1905 and for violently robbing post offices, railway stations, and banks with the help of some Georgian gangsters led by Lenin's friend and comrade, Joseph Stalin. At this point, Nicholas, in his finite wisdom, orders the Russian army to put down the riots by firing on the protesters, and the soldiers refuse his command. Nicholas tries to then rush back to St. Petersburg, but is stuck in a railway station and told by his generals that he needs to abdicate the throne. Now, less than a year prior, before the riots, before the abdication, before Lenin gets on that train or even thinks about riding Norwegian wood, Rasputin tells the Tsarina that God has spoken to him and warned him that elements in the Russian monarchy would try to assassinate him, and if they were successful, it would mean Nicholas's rule would end in less than 2 years. Apparently, God chose to tell Rasputin this information after the monk had already survived one assassination attempt, probably because the Almighty was busy whipping up a batch of Spanish influenza to turn a bad situation into something exponentially worse. Again, cruel dick, bad jokes. And on December 30th, 1916, Rasputin's dark prophecy would be realized when he was poisoned, stabbed, shot, and drowned, again, just for good measure. They're very detail-oriented, the Russians. By elements in the Russian monarchy. So at this point, the Tsarina Alexandra is the only person in all of Russia that had any sense of what was coming. Lenin and his minority party of Bolsheviks then seize power in St. Petersburg, and I'm not saying this to comment on American politics, this is literally what happened, by sending a small but violent mob to storm the Capitol building of the Winter Palace, which then places the Russian Empire under the exclusive control of Vladimir Lenin, who then signs a peace treaty with the Germans, effectively ending Russia's involvement in World War I, and begins to quietly relocate the entire extended lineage of the Romanovs, including the now former Tsar, his wife, and their 5 children, in various locations near the Ural Mountains, slowly and systematically wiping them out one by one. The Tsar, now just some guy named Nick Romanov, and his family are moved to a small 2-story home of a former official in the mining industry, Ipatiev, that had a noticeably spacious basement on the Redfin listing. And on July 17th, at 2 o'clock in the morning, a truck filled with drunken soldiers pulls up to the Ipatiev house, where the Romanov family is rounded up for what they assume is another relocation. Instead, they are brought into the basement as part of a secret operation ordered by Vladimir Lenin with the absolutely fucking chilling title of Chimney Sweep. Each soldier employed in Operation Chimney Sweep was assigned to kill one member of the Romanov family, but once the order was given, many of them felt deeply conflicted about shooting innocent women and children, even through the vodka-fueled haze. And so all 11 of them immediately fire at Nicholas II, murdering him in front of his entire family. Now you can just imagine what that room must have sounded like at that moment. The man in charge of the operation was a certifiable psychopath named Peter Ermakov, who then goes around, one by one, personally murdering every Romanov child until he runs out of bullets and has to continue by gleefully stabbing the remaining family members to death with a bayonet. Now, how do we know that all this was an official order and not just a relocation gone wrong? Peter Ermakov was not only specifically assigned to Chimney Sweep, he was also one of the Bolsheviks involved in some of those bank robberies that Lenin had been exiled for, and he went to prison not just for robbing the bank, but for beheading one of the bank tellers after the fact, just for fun. And the reason we know that this was personally ordered by Vladimir Lenin is because another famous figure of the Bolshevik Revolution, Leon Trotsky, made a note of it in his official writings. When told that not just the Tsar and Tsarina had been killed, but rather the entire Romanov line had been deliberately wiped out, he asked the man who the order had come down through who it was that had initially given it. The man's response, which Trotsky recorded, was Ilyich. In Russia, it is an individual's middle name that is used most often to identify them, and Vladimir Lenin's name at birth was Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. Sound vaguely familiar? Remember that name I asked you to hold on to? The would-be assassin of Nicholas II's father, who Alexander III, Alex III, then had put to death for treason? His name was Alexander Ilyich Ulyanov, the elder brother of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, the man who would come to be known by the entire world as Vladimir Lenin. In 1887, Nicholas Romanov's father, Alex III, murders Vladimir Lenin's older brother, and 31 years later, Vladimir Lenin would exterminate Alexander III's entire family line. How about that for a cycle of violence? Now, I think it might be time for some music, and a little bit more history on the mad monk from Tobolsk, Grigory Rasputin.
Alongside Elizabeth Bathory and Aleister Crowley, this sex-positive and hygiene-negative hobo from the Russian equivalent of Alabama has become something of an obsession for the genre of heavy metal. So here's a little something I put together in honor of the smelliest Slav in Siberia, Grigory Rasputin.
Behold the medley. Ten points!
burn 7 heads. Count your fingers and the continents on your head or in your right hand. This new moral code, Vladimir the Man.
That fucking album. Crack the Sky. God. It's like childbirth. What do you don't immediately get that association? Okay. They say that women frequently forget the pain of childbirth after a certain period of time because it's so fucking excruciating that if they didn't forget, they would never choose to go through it again. So our ancestors that forgot the pain had multiple children and were therefore more likely to pass on their genes. So now we have a world filled with women who forget the pain of childbirth. Still not there yet, huh? Okay. A certain period of time after listening to Crack the Sky, you have to forget how superlatively brilliant it is, because if you didn't, you wouldn't listen to anything else due to the shift in the paradigm reality that occurs once you've heard Crack the Sky, wherein anything else would fucking pale in comparison to the goddamn unrivaled divine lightning ricocheting around in a bottle with genius magic and the DNA of four dudes named Braun, Brent, Bill, and Troy. Now, do you get why Crack the Sky is like childbirth? Because I think I kind of lost the thread there. So that first song was a track called The Last Baron by Mastodon off their 2009 Crack the Sky album, which is really good, if I remember correctly. I don't know. I'll give it a listen again at some point. But in this iteration, Rasputin is an incorporeal time-traveling shade who accompanies a young quadriplegic child on an astral journey to deliver his soul back into his body before it's too late. God, I love the history episodes. The narrator traverses the metaphysical from the perspective of the young boy with floating in the sea, past the King of Swords, quickly to the shore, and ghost of man surrounds me in my slumber. I have no fear with your wing as my shelter. And also the physical from the perspective of Gregory Rasputin, with cyanide he craves, coursing through his veins, providing him with strength to see this to the end. It's actually a redemptive fantasy about Rasputin expanding on his historical role as a mystical caretaker to Alexei. In reality, Rasputin was most likely not a faith healer and probably more like a bullshit artist. In a famous letter to Rasputin while he was out of town, probably using his dick to cut a swath across the Russian countryside, the Tsarina wrote that Alexei's condition had worsened in the monk's absence, to which Rasputin replied simply, "Keep the doctors away from him and he will recover." And sure as Svetlana, he did. Because even though Rasputin was more of a human hard-on than a healer, he knew enough about basic chemistry to realize that the recently discovered wonder drug known as aspirin, which had been invented just before the turn of the century, was a blood thinner. And the Russian medical profession was doling that shit out like ham sandwiches at a hobo convention. What? So rather than just telling the Tsarina and the royal doctors that they shouldn't give blood thinners to someone whose blood doesn't clot, he just let them believe that it was his magical powers that kept Alexei alive, while effectively ensuring that the child would be periodically tortured so he could live-action roleplay as a lawful evil sorcerer on the Romanovs' Rupel. And speaking of guys with perpetually steel Peters, Peter Steele. He was the creative force behind the famed gothic doom metal band out of Brooklyn, Type O Negative.
Brooklyn? These guys is from Brooklyn?
Yeah, they sing songs about Draculas and stuff.
And this is an AV4A first for Type O Negative. I haven't played them yet because, well, they obviously write great stuff, and Peter Steele is a kind of mad genius. They're also something of a funny band. And I'm not really into funny bands. I'm into bands, and I'm into funny, but I'm not into funny bands. Like, I like chocolate, and I like sauerkraut, but I think you can finish the rest of that sentence. Type O Negative opens this album with the title track, Dead Again, the lyrics to which are funny, like so. I can't believe I died last night. Oh God, I'm dead again. I can't believe I died last night. I'm fucking dead again. See, that's funny. To read. But then when you put it to music that sounds really heavy and grave, it doesn't end up feeling either funny or grave to me. It just crosses my wires in a weird way, because what it communicates to me as a listener is, don't take this seriously. The emotion conveyed by the music is really just the setup to a punchline that totally undercuts the entire subject. In this case, death. And look, you guys know me. I'm all about mixing gravity and levity, but something about Type O Negative always says to me, nah, just kidding. And maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. It happened once before. Regardless, the subject at hand is the third track off of 2007's Dead Again, titled The Prophet of Doom, spelled P-R-O-F-I-T. Again, letting you know that the doom and dread of the music is, I guess, ironic. And while the song itself isn't a direct reference to Rasputin, they used his image on the cover, and I think this is Peter Steele playing the role of the modern Mad Monk. There are references to asteroids destroying the world in April of 2029, and obvious biblical shoutouts to the beast with 10 horns and 7 heads. But it's also a pretty typical self-deprecation on Peter Steele's part. Dead Again was Typo Negative's final album before the band dissolved, and 3 years later, Peter Steele would die of heart, liver, and then everything else failure. He had a serious drug and alcohol addiction, and at the time of recording Dead Again, the frontman was in a bad way after a breakup with his girlfriend of 10 years and a stint in Rikers Island prison. The breakup was a result of Steele's girlfriend cheating on him with another guy, and his prison sentence was a result of going to that guy's apartment at 5 in the morning and punching him in the face. As he described his state in a 2008 interview with Metal Hammer, "I tried to mask the pain by drowning myself in cocaine and alcohol until I thought I was the Pope. I used to walk around the streets in Soviet and Nazi uniforms. I put a sign outside my house encouraging burglars and left my front door open. I would lie under the bed wearing night vision goggles waiting for people to come in, and they never did, fucking cocksuckers. I was a complete mess." Yeah, that qualifies. I love fucking cocksuckers. He's getting mad at the imaginary people who aren't playing along with his admittedly delusional behavior. Who makes up fake people to yell at?
Hello, babe!
Get out, I said! So the Prophet of Doom is kind of a portrait of Rasputin slash Peter Steele as doomsayer and a charlatan. Mastodon's portrayal is something out of a psychedelic fantasy novel, while Typo Negative's is more like a tongue-in-cheek autobiography. And then there's the 1978 German disco track by Boney M. called simply Rasputin. We then move on to the Cavalera Conspiracy with their song by the same title. Max and Igor Cavalera are best known. Did you buy it? Did you? The whole me including a European disco track into a medley about Rasputin featuring Mastodon, Typo Negative, and the Cavalera Conspiracy and then just not saying anything about it? Did you buy it? Okay, like, scale of 1 to 10, how convincing was I? 10 being the best. No, 1 being the best, and that way if I get a bunch of bad feedback, I'll just say you guys didn't understand how scoring worked. So yeah, I was looking for songs to put together with The Last Baron and Prophet of Doom, and that song was everywhere. In fact, there are a number of metal covers of that song, and honestly, they're all really bad. So I thought I'd go with the OG, which in this case stands for, okay, Germans. And now we arrive at the Cavalera Conspiracy. The Brazilian brothers who founded Sepultura saw Rasputin as the victim of a violent revolution, listing the many various ways Russian nobles attempted to kill him. On December 16, 1916, Rasputin was lured into a house by a man named Prince Felix Yusupov, who offered the holy man some cakes laced with enough potassium cyanide to kill 6 men. Rasputin ate 2 of them, and then washed it all down with a glass of poison wine. And then, nothing happened for a really long time. Until Rasputin asked for seconds. Felix then went into the kitchen to check for fucks, and finding that he was all out, returned with a pistol and shot the Siberian shaman in the chest. Rasputin then collapsed onto the floor, and when Felix went to check the body grabbed him by the shoulder and repeatedly said his name.
Felix Yusupov. Felix Yusupov. Felix Yusupov.
See? Fuck you, Joe Elliott. Then a bunch of Felix's friends came in and shot Rasputin at least 2 more times in the back. And as the men were discussing what to do with the body, again, the body started to stand up. So they beat and stabbed him repeatedly, wrapped his body in chains, cut a hole in the ice of the Neva River, short for Neva Gon' Die, and dumped him in. An autopsy later found that Rasputin's lungs were filled with water, meaning that he was still fucking alive when they threw him in the river, wherein he gave up the Michael Myers impression and finally drowned. So unlike Dr. Felipe, who had no magical gift for self-healing, magical self-healing seemed to be the only gift Rasputin actually had. They're like the Flash and the Reverse Flash of fake Russian wizards. And finally, we return to The Last Baron, which I always think is like a 7-minute long song, but it's not. It's like 13 minutes long. You see? You gotta forget. So, let's wrap up our series on World War I, because as every European well knows, it's time to call it a night once Americans start showing up. The United States entered the war in April of 1917, and though General John Pershing had plans to scale up into the millions by 1918, the U.S. had only initially deployed 100,000 troops, which General Haig could burn through in an afternoon and still have time to fuck a horse or two before dinner. By March of the following year, Lenin decided he was less interested in using the Russian military to kill German peasants than to kill wealthy Russians. And middle-class Russians. Also poor Russians. It didn't matter. Killing was his business.
And business was good.
Lenin came to power on the platform of three simple lies: peace to the soldiers, ownership to the workers, and land to the peasants. But now that he was in power, not so much. He just replaced one top-down system with another, the difference being that now he and the Bolsheviks were at the top, and the rest of that shit didn't really matter anymore. So he made peace with Germany, effectively ending Russia's involvement in World War I, which meant that the Allies had now officially lost the Eastern Front. So the one question that remained was if France and England could hold on long enough for the influx of American resources to tip the scales in their favor while Germany was trying to fend off their own internal collapse. The German people had been through 4 long years of war, as English naval dominance was slowly but surely starving the empire. Like Russia before them, Germany was now dealing with socialist insurgents and massive protests, including riots and labor strikes, as the appetite for war was being steadily replaced by an appetite for fucking food. To counter these native threats, the German military, which had now taken full control of the country, sponsored something called the Fatherland Party, a right-wing populist movement lavishly financed by the wealthy German industrialists and dedicated to the destruction of all who threatened, quote, traditional German values.
That's not going anywhere. Wouldn't worry about it.
But in addition to their domestic strategy, Germany was also adapting their military strategy with the creation of units called stormtroops. Why am I suddenly getting these deep pangs of dread? I thought this series was coming to a really strong close, but man, something about this part of the episode just feels really ominous. Gotta up my meds. So the German high command, led by a real peach of a guy named Erich Friedrich Wilhelm Ludendorff, decided they had to make one final push for victory. He transferred all of his eastern forces to the western front, and on the 21st of March in 1918, the Ludendorff offensive drove a wedge 40 miles into the British defenses, threatening to separate them completely from the armies of the French. And this is where Sir Douglas Haig steps up to earn himself just the slightest glimmer of redemption. Well known as a deeply inarticulate mental turnip, Haig issued a rare and dramatic order of the day to the English forces, saying,
"We thought back to the wall. Each one must fight on to the end. The safety of our homes and the freedom of mankind alike depend on the conduct of each of us at this critical moment."
Was that the voice I used the last time? I don't remember. Yeah, it's a low bar, but he managed to clear it. The English line held, and on the 30th of April, Ludendorff was forced to break off his attack. One of my many sources for this series is a book by English military historian Michael Howard. No Brits, not that Michael Howard. Feel free to unroll your eyes. I want to read a short passage in which he introduces the U.S. into the story of World War I because I think it's just delightful. Here it is. "The gallantry of inexperience made their losses heavy, but they learned fast. And the very presence of these tall, cheerful, well-fed boys from the Middle West, with their boundless optimism, convinced the weary Allies that the war could not now be lost." As obnoxious as American exceptionalist, optimistic view of itself can be at times, something about this paragraph just feels like a breath of fresh air in this story. And maybe it's because I'm a Yank and a bit of a romantic, but I just swoon at the idea that sometimes what you need is a big, dumb, loud American to just stumble happily into accidental success. It's what I need. And since we're telling stories of redemption, the English, having maintained their stiff upper lip, during the Ludendorff Offensive, and America has shown up to high-five the Allies by ordering ketchup with their pommes frites, it's now France's turn. I think this is my favorite story of the whole war, because Ludendorff wants to make one final push to break the English. But he just can't help how much he fucking hates the French. So he launches one last attack at them on July 16 at Reims. Germany storms the French front lines, occupies their trenches, takes out their machine gun posts, and just generally cakewalks into French territory, only to find said territory is empty. See, German deserters had begun to flee through Allied land and tip the French off to exactly what Ludendorff had planned. So this is the scene in the movie where you see Germany just stomping through the French positions and you're thinking, oh no, the bad guys just won. I want my money back. But then we see the reveal that the French troops are nowhere to be found.
What? Maybe I was too hasty. Take my money again.
The ominous German imperial theme then fades to silence when we suddenly cut to the French artillery commander, played by William Shatner, stepping forward from their hidden flanking position and clenching a determined fist as he gives the order.
Fire!
As the French national anthem, which I think is a song called
I Speak English, Why Don't You Speak French?,
swells to a crescendo, the German army gets absolutely decimated by the country they have been kicking the ever-loving shit out of for 4 long years. By August 5th, 1918, the combined forces of England, France, and the United States reclaim the Western Front and begin to threaten a push toward Berlin. On October 24th, the Italians finally put Austria-Hungary out of its misery, and as it turns out, Germany's creepy little toady with the scary eyes and the Pakaday Marlboro habit, Bulgaria, just can't take a punch. So a reconstituted Serbian army gets by with a little help from their French and forces Bulgaria into surrender, and the remainder of the Central Powers would soon follow suit. And finally, on November 11th at 11 a.m., the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the armistice of 1918 went into effect, and the war to end all wars was finally and mercifully over, as the guns on the Western Front fell silent. And thanks to the audio archives of the Smithsonian, I can actually play the sound of that moment for you. This is something else. Take a listen. Thank you all so much for going on this strange, beautiful, and horrifying journey with me. Like I said at the outset, this was an experiment for AV4A, and I didn't expect everyone to fall in love with the topic as I did. But for those of you who enjoyed listening to this series as much as I enjoyed putting it together, you have my deep and abiding love and gratitude. Thank you. World War I occupies a strange little corner in the heart of heavy metal, and my hope is that through this series, we all have a better understanding of why that is. The First World War was bleak, senseless, and seemingly wholly unnecessary, and maybe that's why so many artists who make the music that we love have chosen to articulate through their work the horrors that come as a consequence of war fought for reasons that no one seems to understand. Heavy metal has elevated the topic of World War I as a critique on the idea of war itself. There is no conflict in world history that more clearly demonstrates how individual, personal folly can accelerate and expand inexplicably into a global disaster that robbed the world of at least 20 million human lives. It's a subject deserving of a grand critique. And for my own strange little corner of the genre, I am incredibly proud that heavy metal music has not and will never shy away from that charge. And on the next and Volume 4 all. We are going to leave all this depressing downer material for greener pastures. We need a pick-me-up. So come on, get happy. As we return to the early 90s to cover one of my favorite bands of all time, I'm not going to tell you who it is. But I will just say this. We are about to dig down in a whole bunch of dirt for this one as we grind our way into a heavy metal deep dive once again on the season 2 finale of And Volume For All. But don't worry, it's not over now. We've got one more series to go before we return with a mad season 3 of episodes.
It's Alice in Chains.
I'm going to do Alice in Chains. Sorry, I'm bad with secrets. How bad, you ask? Well, Mother Punchers, it is time, once again, to fuck around and find out on the next And Volume For All.